Next case on our calendar, 06-1033, City of St. Mary's versus Auglaize County Board of Commissioners. Mr. Hierman.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is Henry Hierman, and I, along with my partner, Alvin Bauer, are representing the Auglaize County Board of Commissioners. I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Watch your timer on the clock.
Thank you. With the enactment of House Bill 592, all counties in Ohio had to organize themselves into single-county or multi-county solid waste districts. The City of St. Mary's needed Auglaize County solid waste stream in order to continue to operate its landfill in a cost-effective manner. It did not want Auglaize County to join a multi-county solid waste district and risk the possibility that the county's waste stream could be diverted to another landfill. This provided the genesis for the 1988 agreement, which is now before this court. So in December 1988, the city had its environmental consultant, Hull & Associates, draft the agreement. The agreement had to be for at least 10 years. The parties chose to make it a 12-year agreement. This is what the parties intended, and this is what the agreement clearly stated. The city drafted the agreement. It would have been very easy for the city to put in a separate survival paragraph to the effect that the obligations in paragraph 5A or any other paragraph will survive the termination of this agreement.
This is basically a contract dispute, is it not? You're
yes,
arguing
Your
over the language in the contract and what it means, correct?
Yes, and also a certification issue, Your Honor.
Okay. And in your contract dispute, you argue that you need explicit survival language, but the Court of Appeals found that language in the words that you assume complete responsibility prior to and subsequent to closure of the landfill. Why is that not that point not simply a contract matter? You want more specific language?
Yes, Your
Honor.
The
other side thinks it's specific enough. Where is there any issue for us?
The closure of the landfill is merely an event that could occur and in fact did occur during the term of the agreement. Whenever you say subsequent or after an event that can occur before the termination of the agreement, that's not the same as saying subsequent or after the termination of the agreement.
So your explicit survival language, is that a new requirement of contracts that we would be writing law on?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it is. I believe that it would be consistent with this court's holding in Altman versus Blue Cross, where the court held that there can be no implied covenant to a matter that's specifically covered in the contract.
So you believe we already have court language that covers this issue?
Consistent. I don't believe it's right on point when you look at the courts in other jurisdictions that have specifically held that when, similar to our proposition of law number one, that states to the effect that when a contract specifies a period of duration, all of the obligations of the parties to that contract terminate on the expiration of that contract unless the agreement specifically provides or explicitly provides for an obligation to continue beyond the termination date.
And that's the proposition law you want us to write.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you just don't believe that prior to and subsequent to closure of the landfill is specific enough for your purposes?
Yes.
Well, we're on the subject of the closing of the land over here on the right end. As we're on the subject of closing the landfill, the contract provided that St. Mary's would provide landfill space for 12 years, yet they terminated about 2.5 years early, as I understand it. Did the county consider that a breach of the contract when it occurred, or is this simply a defensive argument to the lawsuit by St. Mary's?
I believe it's a defensive argument because St. Mary's failed to substantially perform the agreement. The breach was that St. Mary's closed the landfill and did not provide any other alternative disposal capacity for the remainder of the 12 years of the agreement, such as a transfer station. It's not at all uncommon in triple net leases for, to give an example, for a tenant to assume the responsibilities of the landlord during the term of the agreement. And a triple net lease could say that the tenant is responsible for all taxes and assessments, both prior to and subsequent to the construction of a building to be constructed on the real estate. But that doesn't mean that after the lease expires that the tenant is going to be responsible to continue paying for the taxes and assessments. There's a big difference between making a clear statement that party's obligations are going to continue after the expiration of an agreement and merely saying that the party's obligations are going to continue after an event, especially when the event can occur within the term. That was precisely the holding of the Lorain County Court of Appeals in Chicago West Pullman versus Quinn, which we cited in our briefs. In that case, the court said that the settlement of the Cardinal lawsuit could have occurred during the term of the agreement. And so we're not going to hold that the reimbursement clause, the obligation for reimbursement, is going to continue after the agreement was terminated.
What value should we place on the the evidence to which the appellee refers, that indicates that the county hired a consultant and had the consultant make projections, the monitoring requirements out 30 years out? If it's relevant, it supports the city's position, does it not, that the county anticipated that its obligation would extend beyond 12 years?
No, Your Honor. First of all, the county did not hire the environmental consultant. That was the city's environmental consultant. The district did not hire Hall and Associates till June, I believe, 1989. What Your Honor is referring to is a feasibility study that the city had prepared before the agreement was executed to show how much was going to be needed for the construction of a new BAT facility and how much in the way of rates the city would have to charge at its landfill. Now, subsequent to the execution of the agreement, just three short months later, the city had the same environmental consultant, Holland and Associates, who was hired by the city to perform a rate study, as is required by paragraph 8A of the agreement. And in that rate study, Hall concluded that the city would have to increase their gate fee from $6.94 to $34.95, a $28.01 increase, in order to accumulate enough funds during the 13-year active life of the landfill to pay for such things as the new BAT cell, and also to pay for monitoring both prior to and subsequent to the closure. Hall estimated in March of 1989, the city's consultant, that it would cost $2.4 million at that time for post-closure monitoring. That amount was included in the rate fee. Now, if Hall and the city at that time thought that the county was going to be continuing to pay for post-closure monitoring for 30 years, there would have been no reason for Hall to include in his rate study the cost of post-closure monitoring and have the city collect that amount during the 13 years. The fact is that Hall and the city both understood at the time the agreement was executed and just three short months later in March 1989 that the county's obligation and the county was not going to be paying for any post-closure monitoring after the agreement expired.
Could I ask you to address the issue that I think we're here is concerning the county's obligation to pay absent the county auditor certification of the availability of funds?
To the extent that the county has any financial obligation under this agreement, whether it is in paragraph 5A or paragraph 9A, that amount needed to be certified at the time the agreement was entered into. According to the city, this is an open-ended amount that has no time limitation or even any dollar amount. The parties did not know in 1988, and you can't tell at this point what the dollar amount is that the county is going to be liable for under the city's interpretation of the agreement. On two occasions, the Ohio Attorney General, both in 1999 and in 2005, has had occasion to look at the enforceability of such an indemnity type obligation that a county assumes. And on both occasions, the Attorney General has opined that such agreements are not enforceable unless there's a maximum amount stated in the contract as to the county's obligation, and that maximum amount is certified at the time the agreement is entered into, and funds for that maximum amount are encumbered at that time. Otherwise, you would in fact be having the county write a blank check and would be invading the treasury, and that's precisely what Revised Code 570541D is meant to prevent.
You don't think that the exemption for a contract that extends beyond the fiscal year applies here?
No, Your Honor. As the Attorney General stated, that even in the case of a continuing contract, when you have this indemnity type obligation within that contract, that provision needs to be certified. There needs to be a maximum amount stated so the funds can be encumbered and that amount can be set aside. Otherwise, the agreement is void. Now, I don't believe that this is a continuing contract because it's not a divisible contract. But even in the case of a continuing contract, if you have an indemnity or a hold harmless provision in such a continuing contract, there still needs to be stated a maximum amount. And this agreement did not state a maximum amount, and no funds, it was never certified, and no funds were encumbered.
Now, this issue was raised to the Court of Appeals, I believe.
Yes, Your Honor.
But I was looking in the decision, and I couldn't find where they decided this issue. Did the Court of Appeals actually pass on this issue?
I couldn't find that either. I believe the Court of Appeals, for some reason, just did not address it. The trial court did, however, address it. And what the trial court found is that the agreement clearly provided that under the contract, the city had an obligation to pay for the funds out of the landfill rate, which was a public utility, and therefore was exempt because it was the earnings of a public utility.
Well, counsel, is it your contention then, because the auditor did not certify the funds back in 1988, it didn't certify it because it was not envisioned that this duty would be present, or are you saying that that flaw negates the obligation?
I'd say the flaw negates the obligation. Even under 9A, there was supposed to be this backstop obligation, and there was no maximum amount stated in the agreement.
So are you saying that there was an obligation to monitor it for 30 years?
No.
But this failure on part of procedurally going through the encumbrance of the dollars preclude it from being enforceable?
there was not a 30-year monitoring obligation. There was a 12-year obligation. And even a 12-year obligation, the failure to certify it prevents it from being enforceable. I see that I would like to reserve the remainder, such
Thank
as it is.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank Mr. Your Honor, we would ask that the court reverse the Court of Appeals in this instance.
Thank you. Mr. Ingram.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, I am Bruce L. Ingram, appearing on behalf of the appellee, St. Mary's, the City of St. Mary's, along with my colleagues Craig Noble and Philip Downey. We respectfully request that this court affirm the judgment of the Third District Court of Appeals. The appellant is really asking this
before
court,
we get too far, yes. I'm bound up in the right. Before we get too far along, what is your observation about whether the Court of Appeals actually addressed the issue about the requirement of a certification by the auditor? Did they decide that issue?
Not that I could find in that opinion, Your Honor. I would like to say, though, with respect to what the trial court decided on that issue, was that this was both a continuing contract, which exempts this from the Burns Law application, but it was also a contract for the payment of money out of the earnings of a public utility. So the trial court found both of those exemptions to be applicable here. And I might also point out that the only authority that was cited to this court to support the claim that the Burns Law applies to this contract is an attorney general opinion. The attorney general opinion was inconsistent with an earlier attorney general opinion, and in fact, there have been five decisions of three courts of appeals which have held that contracts, intergovernmental contracts of this type, are not subject to the Burns Law. So I would urge this court to reject the proposition of law that the Burns Law applies here and instead adopt the position taken by three courts of appeals that the Burns Law does not apply to this type of public contract.
Do they cite statutory authority for that, or are they arguing public policy in their decision?
I believe that is primarily public policy, and the rationale for that is in public contracts where there is a dispute as to which taxing unit or taxpaying unit will bear the burden of a breach of contract that it will not be able to enforce, that the court should instead look to the contract, whether it was certified or not, and carry out the intention of those parties and enforce it in accordance with the intent of the parties at the time the contract was signed. I think it's primarily a public policy exception, and indeed, I think in this case, the Ohio Municipal League has filed a brief, an amicus curiae brief, which advises the court that if this court were to find that the Burns Law applies to this contract and voids this contract, that this will create mass confusion in public law. Lawyers will be scurrying to their contracts to see if their clients can get out of their obligations because it was a contract that was not certified at the time by the county auditor. And I think in this case, this is clearly a continuing contract. I really don't think that there can be any doubt that the parties understood that this post-closure or monitoring obligation was going to extend way beyond the fiscal year in which this contract was entered into. The contract was entered into in December of 1988, as I recall. There was no money paid in 1988. All of the obligations, all of the money was paid after 1988, in fact, from 1989 through 2000 approximately. So there were continuing obligations that extended beyond the fiscal year in which the contract was made. That, frankly, is the simple explanation as to why the Burns Law shouldn't apply here.
Mr. Ingram, the Court of Appeals makes the statement that the terms of the contract itself require the county to pay for the post-closure environmental monitoring costs for the entire 30-year post-closure monitoring period. Where in the contract is the reference to the 30-year post-closure monitoring?
It is specifically, Your Honor, in paragraph 5. And in paragraph 5 of the contract, the county had complete responsibility for all environmental monitoring, and here's the important point that to answer your question. All environmental monitoring required by statute and regulation. And it's the statutes and regulations that require post-closure monitoring of 30 years.
However, the contract term itself, as Mr. Heerman is pointing out, was a 12-year contract period. And as I understand the appellant's argument, it's that the contract term itself should define the obligations. Here, the closure occurred before the contract ended, correct? So it does make sense to talk about pre- and post-closure monitoring obligations.
The closure did, in fact, occur prior to 12 years expiring after the agreement was entered into. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, paragraph 5.5 is a specific contract reference to environmental monitoring and that responsibility, and that would prevail over any general contract term, such as paragraph 2, which refers to a 12-year term of the agreement.
Well, if you talk about the monitoring requirements during the contract period, I mean, there's a big difference between 2 and 30 years. When the court says there was a specific reference in the contract, I'm looking for the language that says 30-year monitoring are required.
I'd respectfully suggest, Justice Lansinger, that the required by statute and regulation incorporates whatever post-closure, pre-closure monitoring requirements there are at that site. It incorporates by reference the statutes and regulations applicable to environmental monitoring. So we're not attempting to imply 30 years. It is specific. The regulations are specifically incorporated by reference into this specific paragraph and govern the obligation of the county over a general statement in paragraph 2 that the term of the agreement is 12 years.
If the contract had terminated at the 12 years, then the argument that the closure only requires doesn't apply to this contract. I mean, if it went to 12 years, then that language would have no meaning, and subsequent to the closure of the landfill, if we took that interpretation,
correct,
that it ended early.
Well, had the contract continued for 12 years, had the landfill been open at 12 years, there would have been no reason for this paragraph 5 not to incorporate the post-closure monitoring responsibilities as required by regulation.
Mr. Ingram, if
yes, Your Honor.
If the rules changed, it would be your argument that if the rule changed to there has to be monitoring in perpetuity, that would be the county's obligation as well.
Absolutely, and that's not a harsh result.
And does the contract make any provision of if as a result of the monitoring the state or federal government determined that remediation was required, does it provide who bears the responsibility for that?
Yes, I believe that under this contract, the city bears the responsibility for remediation. This is simply monitoring. This is monitoring of the environmental equipment that is installed on the landfill. So it's not a remediation issue. I'd also like to point out an answer.
So if 20 years down the road, as a result of the monitoring that is required to be maintained, that determined that there was now leaching of something that was dangerous to the residents or dangerous to Lake St. Mary's or something of that nature, the city would bear the responsibility for that.
That's correct. This is simply a monitoring obligation. I would like to address something that Justice Cupp mentioned earlier to the appellants, And that is, I believe the justice asked, did the county at the time the landfill closed consider this a breach, or was this just defensive to the lawsuit that was filed to enforce the obligations of the county? And I believe I heard Mr. Hoyerman say that this was defensive. In fact, he is absolutely correct. The closing of the landfill and the failure to set aside an appropriate part of the rate, these are all make-weight arguments that were purely defensive at the time, that were made at the time after the contract had been performed for 12 years and everyone knew exactly how this contract was being performed, and during which there was plenty of opportunity to object either to the closure of the landfill or to the way in which funds were set aside for environmental monitoring. And it was only when 12 years later they stopped paying for the monitoring, St. Mary's sought by litigation to enforce that contract, that all of a sudden now these breaches are alleged by the county. And I believe that speaks volumes with respect to what this case is all about.
Did the monitoring funds at the county run dry at the end of 12 years, or had they actually run out of funds before that time, or are there still funds left available after 12 years? Does the record reflect that?
I believe the record does reflect some of that. The fact is the city of St. Mary's paid over to the county approximately $1.7 million over the course of 12 years, or 10 years at least, as the district surcharge. During that period of time, the county spent somewhat less than $500,000 on environmental monitoring. The county should have had sufficient resources remaining to pay for the environmental monitoring up through today. We do know that in 1997, the county established a new environmental monitoring fund and put in that fund $167,000. And it did pay some environmental monitoring out of that. And then once the litigation started, I believe the expenses of the attorneys representing the county were paid out of the fund that was set aside in 1997 for environmental monitoring. And I believe at one point the record will reflect, after the litigation started, the fund that had been set aside in 1997 had been exhausted.
I'd like to direct your attention to this fund. It's established by paragraph 9 of the agreement. And of course, subsection A there is the fund for the environmental monitoring. But the interesting part is subsection I, which indicates what happens if the agreement is terminated prior to the stated expiration date, what happens to the accumulated money. And in paragraph I, it indicates that the funds would be divided pro rata between the city and the county based on where the landfill capacity is. And of course, there was only in the city of St. Mary's. Which would mean, as I would look at that the city of St. Mary's would get the entire monitoring fund. Does that provide some evidence of the party's intent that the county would, at least as far as the landfill located in St. Mary's, would not be responsible for continuing monitoring after the agreement ended?
Well, number one, Your Honor, I don't believe so in light of the specific reference in paragraph 5 that I've alluded to, that the county had responsibility for all monitoring as required by statute and regulation. I believe, but I can only do this by speculation, that this paragraph I was intended that if for some unforeseen reason the entire agreement had to be terminated and the parties went their separate ways, that there was going to be required some adjustment of this money left over in this fund. And why shouldn't St. Mary's take an allocated portion of this fund to pay for environmental monitoring after the agreement terminated? Because once the agreement was early terminated, then St. Mary's would in fact have have funds to carry out environmental monitoring, but that does not in any way override paragraph 5.
So they would do it in addition to the county? They would?
Well, only in the event of some prior termination of the agreement. There was no prior termination of the agreement. But assuming that there was some prior termination of this agreement, then clearly this contract requires that there is some allocation of this fund. And I can't explain why there would be an allocation of this fund in paragraph I, but the fact is this fund, this was never terminated prior to 1990. This agreement continued through 1990, and there was no need to divide up any fund, and particularly given, as the parties agreed, paragraph 5A requires environmental monitoring as required by statute and regulation. I would simply like to point out in closing that the argument that the rate here was not properly set is a false argument. The fact is the contract simply required that the city establish a rate, and out of that rate would come amounts for a fund to be administered by the county through the Solid Waste Management District to pay for environmental monitoring. The district consultant...
Up your lights, been on.
Thank you very much. I'd simply ask that the court affirm the Third District Court of Appeal.
Thank you, Mr. Ingram. Mr. Hiraman, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to point out that the funds that the city paid were always district funds. They were to be used for district activities, including the preparation of the district solid waste plan, the district's recycling plan. The city never paid over any portion of its rate to the district for monitoring throughout the life of the agreement. And I'd also like to point out that even if the landfill had remained open at the end of the 12-year term, that doesn't mean that back in 1988, at the time the agreement was entered into, that the words subsequent to the closure did not have any meaning, because it took into the account the distinct possibility that the landfill could close. And the final point I'd like to make is that there is no statutory authority for any kind of exemption for contracts between governmental entities. The treasuries of governmental entities can be invaded just as much by contracts between governmental entities as they can between a governmental entity and a private party. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.